Coming up on Athens News Matters, former State Representative Deborah Gonzalez on her campaign for district attorney.
There is a difference between how much time that a person is sentenced to just based on their race.
Plus, lots of kids are picky eaters, but what happens when picky eating becomes an eating disorder? This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ripley. Also today, breastfeeding is legal and protected by state and federal law in Georgia. But new research says women still face significant hurdles when they exercise their right to breastfeed.
We wanted to see how well workplaces were doing in terms of meeting those provisions.
Those stories, the week in news and politics, and more are coming up on Athens News Matters.
My name is Gemma DiCarlo, and I'm a senior journalism major at UGA. I started out as a news intern here and eventually moved into production. I now produce for Athens News Matters. I came to WUGA as a lifelong radio listener, but I wasn't sure if it was something I wanted to do as a job. 6 months later, though, I can confidently say that I want my future career to take place in public media. After graduation, I hope to find a job in production at a small or mid-sized station like WUGA.
Learn more about WUGA internships at WUGA.org.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Last year, the Athens-Clark County Animal Shelter was at the center of public outcry after euthanizing dozens of cats feared to have contracted a contagious disease. A month later, state officials closed the shelter's canine facilities in an unrelated matter. In the wake of those incidents, the county official who oversaw the shelter resigned, and ACC commissioners introduced a package of reforms. WUGA's Gemma DiCarlo brings us this update.
ACC Animal Services is located in a quiet part of town near Ben Epps Airport, but the building itself is anything but quiet. As volunteers bustle in and out, dogs are barking for their afternoon feeding. A few visitors play with animals, searching for their next furry friend. It's a busy scene, which interim director Sayla Gardner says is pretty common.
We literally never know on a day-to-day basis what to expect. It can be a day where it's calm, and then the next day or the next hour, it could be complete chaos.
Compared to the noisy exuberance of the kennels, the cat room is pretty quiet, a few dozen cats taking naps. But the cat room was ground zero for a major controversy last year. Sayla Gardner stepped in as interim director when Animal Services was first formed back in October 2019. Before that, the department was part of ACC Central Services, where it received backlash after an outbreak of the feline panleukopenia virus turned out to be a false alarm. Over two dozen cats were euthanized before contagious disease tests came back negative.
We didn't have the proper protocols in place to deal with a situation like that. And that made the opportunity for communication breakdowns. One of the problems was that we had this very specialized department, animal control, under central services, a very broad, that does everything from maintaining our buildings and stuff like that. We realized that we needed to take animal services out of central services. It needed to be its own department with its own department head that answered directly to the county manager's office. And that was just one of the biggest things that we realized that we really needed to kind of like tackle and change.
That was District 5 Commissioner Tim Denson, who held a town hall meeting last September in the wake of the Panluke incident. He said the meeting was tense at times, with local animal welfare organizations and community members calling for action. By involving those organizations in the restructuring of animal services, Denson hopes to heal those relationships and rebuild trust in the department.
They are, I think, cautiously optimistic is what I would say. And I understand that, right? We have to earn back these individuals' trust and these groups' trust. And I think that the manager's office is going in the right direction with this, with really showing that these stakeholders are, they're really a part of the process.
Over the last several months, Animal Services has been working with the manager's office and external stakeholders like AthensPets.net and the local Humane Society to develop a 5-year strategic plan for its future. Sayla Gardner again.
We want to set forward a vision for who we want to be, what our organization's values are, and how we can really kind of become a better animal services department for Athens-Clark County and a shelter, I think, of merit in general.
The plan covers animal services' traditional roles, sending out animal control, helping people deal with animal bites, housing and returning lost pets. But Gardner says she wants it to be viewed as more of an adoption center than an animal shelter.
I think that we want to be able to lose any sort of negative connotation of being the pound or the place that animals go to be euthanized. Like, we really want to, within reason, try to move our live release rate up. We want to be able to utilize our community as fosters, as volunteers, as, you know, partnerships that can really help this organization move forward.
That community partnership is what Gardner wants most for animal services. In the future, she wants it to serve as a community resource, not just a field service dispatch.
We are trying to work in our strategic plan on developing more of a, you know, kind of community resource component, whether it's partnering possibly with some, you know, other human resources. So if you're already utilizing the food bank and you have pets, chances are you also can't feed your pets. So, you know, we're trying to think big picture as we move forward with our strategic plan on what it is that we should also be thinking about, rather than just housing animals and, you know, responding to field service calls. What other things does this community need?
Animal Services will present its strategic plan to the mayor and commission on Tuesday, February 11th. For Athens News Matters, I'm Gemma DiCarlo.
Former State Representative Deborah Gonzalez is running for district attorney, a position held for nearly 20 years by incumbent Ken Malden, who is not running again. Gonzalez, a Democrat, joins us to talk about her campaign. Deborah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Love it.
What sort of changes would you like to see in Athens-Clarke County?
Well, one, the data that we saw, just take the juvenile justice system for a minute. The data came out that between 2014 and 2018, if we look at the cases that are actually prosecuted, we find that over about 76% of the cases are against Black boys. Now, they form less than 15% of the population.
Those are pretty shocking numbers.
They are. But what's even more shocking is if you go one more level down in the research and you say, okay, but what are they getting prosecuted for? And you find that 76% of the prosecutions are for loitering.
Wow.
Now, it might not be the only charge, right, that they get, but they might have other charges. But that seems to be one that keeps coming up. And you're saying, okay, I'm looking at the trends that are happening in our country and seeing that they're being reflected right here in Georgia and right here in my neighborhood, that we are criminalizing certain behaviors simply because of the color of a person's skin. And you see these discrepancies in our courtrooms. There is a difference between how much time that a person is sentenced to just based on their race. And, you know, I know people will say, well, it's not intentional. You know, we're just trying to do our job and that comes in. But I think the problem is that when you have a system in place for as long as we've had, 48 years, right, and we haven't questioned, we haven't had the conversation about what's happening in this system and really opening our eyes, then you don't see the problems, right? And, you know, I know people say, well, she's an outsider. She's the interloper. She doesn't know about our system and all that. And sometimes that's what you need, right? You need fresh eyes. And the other thing is, I'm not beholden to anybody. We need somebody who's bold, who's fearless, who can look outside of the courtroom. If you only think of the DA as a prosecuting attorney that has to be in the courtroom getting these people convicted, then you're going to miss out on the bigger picture of a DA who can be a leader in the community. We know that we need to hold people accountable. And in fact, I've spoken with so many stakeholders in the system, including people who were formerly incarcerated. And all of them will say, look, if I did something wrong, I expect to be held accountable. But don't make it punitive. Don't make it cruel. And that's what's happened with our system, right? That we've gone beyond this idea of rehabilitation or of holding people accountable to sort of saying, you know what, we demonize people. We know that 95% of the people who are incarcerated are released. And we have to start asking ourselves, well, are we preparing them to go back? Are we sending better people or better criminals? And, you know, I keep a quote on my desk by Brian Stevenson, who's the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. And he says, you know, the opposite of poverty is not wealth. The opposite of poverty is justice, right? And if we don't take care of our justice system, people are going to get locked into these generational barriers and they'll never get out.
You are a former state representative. And is there any knowledge or experience from your stint at the Capitol that you are bringing that can be applied in this position as well?
Oh, absolutely. See, people don't understand. There are 49 district attorneys in Georgia, right? We have 49 judicial districts. And these 49 individuals actually form their own group that can go and lobby or give opinions about different legislation coming through for the criminal laws, right? And so knowing people, having colleagues who are in the legislature, I can go and say, hey, you know, we're talking about this. This bill is going to have this ramification. What can we do? And also find out. So currently, I am at the Capitol every Tuesday with the Southern Center of Human Rights. They are doing these Talk Justice Tuesdays where they discuss a different aspect of the criminal legal system every Tuesday. So last week we talked about money. This week we're going to be talking about mass incarceration, looking at the legislation that's coming through, looking at the arguments, pros and cons of what's happening to keep us informed. Because what happens in Atlanta affects what's going to happen in Athens and Oconee. And it's important that we understand the way that those things are.
Deborah Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alexia.
Deborah Gonzalez is a Democrat running for district attorney in the Western Judicial Circuit, which covers Athens, Clark, and Oconee County. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
I'm Michael LaHusky at the Georgia Museum of Art. We're an underwriter at WUGA. Having our announcements on WUGA gives us an opportunity to direct people to our website, freeinspiration.art, where they can find out more about our exhibitions and our many programs. We feel it's a great way to get our message out to all of Athens, all of its citizens, and all of Georgia. Find out how you can become an underwriter by emailing wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. Joining me now in our studio to talk about the week in news and politics are education activist Fred Smith and Athens-Clark County Commissioner Russell Edwards. I want to thank you both for joining me today, gentlemen.
My pleasure.
Great to be with you.
Now, to start things off today, the Clark County School District has a community meeting coming up about the West Broad School site. We talked about the site last week, and I wanted to talk to you two about your opinions on the proposal for the West Broad site.
Okay. Well, I'm pleased with the way it's going. Initially, I supported the garden being there. I thought it was great, and I'm an old farm boy, so garden is kind of in my blood.
Organic.
And, yeah, and I'm enjoying being, you know, seeing it and going over there. But once the superintendent made the decision that the facility was needed for early education, it was hard for me to be against that. So I'm pleased. I understand that I attended the last meeting with the architects, and they discussed mainly at that time saving the most historic building there. And so I'm pleased about that. And there's some discussion about, well, the building that was constructed in the 1950s, well, it can be saved as well.
We will see you at a subsequent meetings, is what you were saying.
Sure, yes.
And Russell?
I too was sad to see the garden go. I had some fun memories there with my family visiting. I thought it was a great meeting place for the community. And I've look forward to hearing what comes out of these discussions, the listening sessions that are being hosted right now at the West Broad School. You know, it's an important part of Athens history. It was a segregated elementary school, and it's a beautiful building, and it's wrapped in that history, and it's a physical reminder of Athens history. It's not going anywhere. So figuring out creative ways that we can tell that story to reach the most possible amount of people here in this community and kind of raise the consciousness of the community and sort of fulfill the mission of CCSD by teaching kids, but also of teaching the community at large.
So the plan is to preserve one of the three buildings, but not the other two. Do either of you have concerns about possibly only one building being saved?
Well, I would like to see, again, as much of the site as possible to be saved. For various reasons, they're saying that the building that was constructed in the 1950s, that it's not maybe as historic, and also that it has structural concerns. But I've said at the meeting, and I would say again, that that building is just as important as the Barrow School building and the Chase building. And there are right now seem to be maybe a limit. They're putting a limit on the perhaps the amount of funding that is allocated to saving it. But we're saying that that's artificial, and we need to be willing to go to the extent that we went as a community to save and preserve Barrow and Chase.
I do want to add also, it's possible that the state might turn down the proposal because the site is only 3 acres instead of the 5-acre minimum, and because the site fronts onto a busy 4-lane road.
You know, and I, from my understanding, the state would at the appropriate time review the site for the intended use and then make recommendations for architectural enhancements that would mitigate the concerns raised through the review, which might include the road frontage, as you referenced, and the fact it's close to a commercial entity that sells alcohol, the fact that it's a smaller site than what's allowed today. You know, they'll make a review, but then they'll issue recommendations that the county could implement to come into compliance. I think that's probably the outcome that we'd see, as opposed to just an outright ban. You agree, Fred? I think that's kind of...
Well, I would hope so. And this would not be a typical school. It would not be an elementary school. It would be part of an existing pre-K program. So that may have some influence on the final decision as well.
And staying with the Clark County School System, the Board of Education appointed a new member recently. That's Antoine Stevens in District 2. Now, since Stevens was selected, there have been some concern about the board not choosing a Latino member, given that the district is about 25% Latino. Do you think the board missed an opportunity?
Well, maybe, perhaps. I'm glad that issue has come up, and there will be other opportunities now that I think is on the radar for a Latino person to be on the board. There will be some elections that are coming up this year.
Well, yeah, District 2, the seat that got filled, the vacated seat that got filled, is up for election this May.
That's a possibility. And then there are 4 other seats that are up. And
yeah,
perhaps a Latino would run in those districts as well.
Yeah, you got the District 2 race, you got District 4, District 6, and District 8. So all 4 of those districts are up. And, we've heard from John Knox has issued a statement in District 8 that he's not running for re-election, so there's an open seat.
So keeping our focus on local issues for a moment, elsewhere on the show, I talked to Deborah Gonzalez, who is running for district attorney, and I want to get your reaction to something she said that struck me.
That's what's happened with our system, right? That we've gone beyond this idea of rehabilitation or of holding people accountable to sort of saying, you know what, we demonize people. We know that 95% of the people who are incarcerated are released. And we have to start asking ourselves, well, are we preparing them to go back? Are we sending better people or better criminals?
So 95% of the people who are currently behind bars will be released. And are we doing enough?
I think that we've made strides in this state to establish accountability courts and pretrial diversion, and Athens has been a leader in that field with our drug court, our family violence court, mental health court. So those programs have provided alternatives for folks, alternatives to jail time, and I think we've seen positive results across the state. One unfortunate aspect of this whole conversation and the whole present day situation in Georgia is that we got a $1 billion shortfall resulting from an income tax cut that was passed last year. And cuts to these programs are on the table, along with increases to private prison corporations and increases in gang task force. So, you know, the days of the Republican Nathan Deal administration, where these accountability courts were put in place and pioneered across this state, they seem to have ended. It appears that they have ended now. Now that the budget has been released, that shows cuts for these programs and increases in private prison funding. So I think that these points made by Deborah Gonzalez running for DA are those are the ones that need to be made right now.
I agree. We're not doing enough on the front end to educate, particularly African Americans who end up in the school to prison pipeline. And then we're not doing enough for those who are there to try to ensure that they come out in a better position to not to go back again. And so, no, we're not doing enough. And she's correct.
Finally today, Sam Raffle, a former EMT and founder of the group WhenEverySecondCounts.org, has a pretty scathing letter in this week's flagpole about national EMS and EMS service in Athens. Does Athens have an EMS problem?
I think that's a great question, you know, and one way that that question could be answered would be to open up the meetings of the EMS Oversight Committee to the public. And I just can't wrap my head around why these meetings are still being held behind closed doors. We have serious questions raised about the efficacy of this system, about the response times. There was a troubling incident at Barrow Elementary that triggered these back and forths in the Flagpole magazine. I can't figure out why these meetings are not being held publicly. Folks are worried, and keeping these meetings closed does nothing but feed into the paranoia that folks question whether or not the ambulance is going to get there in time. That's horrible.
A lot of this started around a call from a school. And so it's kind of strange to me that at this point that has not been resolved, because we're talking about emergency services.
That's our time for this week. Thanks to my guests, community activist Fred Smith and District 7 Commissioner Russell Edwards. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
I'm Paul Farr. I am the marketing director for Athens Area Habitat for Humanity. Since underwriting with WUGA, we feel that we have strengthened our ties with the community and that the community at large better understands what we do. WUGA believes everyone should have access to knowledge and wonder. So we build homes for the body. WUGA builds a home for the mind and the heart. And we believe that both are necessary for a good life. So if you want to find out how you can become an underwriter, just email wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Georgia voters have a rare opportunity this year to vote for two U.S. senators. And one of those races got a lot more interesting this week with the announcement that Congressman Doug Collins, a North Georgia Republican, is jumping into the race. Our politics editor, Martin Matheny, sat down with UGA Associate Professor of Political Science, Audrey Haynes to talk about the state of the race.
Dr. Audrey Haynes, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here.
So Georgia has two U.S. Senate races on the ballot in November. There's one that's the seat held by David Perdue, and that's the one that's scheduled to be up. But there's also going to be a special election for the seat formerly held by Johnny Isaacson, who retired, and Kelly Loeffler was appointed by Brian Kemp, right?
That is absolutely correct.
So today I want to focus on former Isaacson seat, because that's the one that's really been in the news recently. And the big news that came out this week is that Congressman Doug Collins is going to get into that race. What does that mean for Kelly Loeffler?
Well, that's a great question. So this is a jungle primary, as we call it, but it also is known under the name of sort of the top two. So basically, you pile everybody in, and they're Democrats and Republicans, strong candidates, weak candidates. If they meet the qualifying, they're in. The goal of top two, generally, and they use it in California, the goal was to put all these people in, and hopefully in the end, you get someone who has to appeal to a more general population. And what do you think you'd get out of that? You'd get someone who is more moderate, right? Well, under polarization the way we are today, who knows? Some of us think that when you have a jungle primary like that, it plays to a bias of not so much more moderate, but who are the strongest candidates. They could be within one party, so you lessen competition. So in this case, now that Doug Collins is in and Kelly Loeffler, you might have all kinds of scenarios that come in. And I think the Democratic Party in the state is probably quite happy that he has jumped into the race, because he is a defined candidate. He is very closely aligned with President Trump. You know, the amount of political capital that Doug Collins has expended to support Trump has been huge. You know, Loeffler is going to have to distinguish herself in a way that appeals to voters. She could talk about issues that are of concern to people, where they get the Trump alignment, because she has obviously gone through her talking points. But then she could sort of increase her authenticity, which some people have complained about, like, oh, you know, she doesn't seem very authentic at this point in time, by talking about the things that mean a lot to her. You know, take the Trump alignment as a given and start talking about the things that she cares about. In the end, if they turn this around and make it into a set of primaries that take place in May and include that, you know, basically eliminate the jungle primary.
And there is a House bill that's moving through right now that would do that.
Yes, which is very political. And a lot of people are thinking about, you know, what is strategically behind this. In the case, if you have a primary, that's better for the Democrats, because it guarantees them a seat at the table at the November election. Without that, there is some potential to have two Republicans, you know, be the top two candidates.
I want to just one final question. And you can't talk about politics on any level right now without talking about the Trump effect. So the sort of elements that I'm looking at here, in 2018, President Trump took credit for Brian Kemp's runoff win over Casey Cagle. Whether that's an accurate assertion or not is for other people to figure out. But certainly, the president seems to believe that he's responsible for Brian Kemp being in the governor's office.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard that, looking at the Senate appointment, that the president was very much in favor of Doug Collins. A lot of the president's typical base in Georgia in favor of Doug Collins. How big of a spot is Brian Kemp in right now in terms of parts of the Trump base and maybe to the president himself?
I am certain, absolutely certain, that it wasn't Governor Kemp going, you know what, I'm going to choose Kelly Loeffler just because I can. And I think he was very considerate of
it. Was a strategic decision.
It was a strategic decision. And in his mind, he was doing it not only to help Georgia Republicans, but also to help win a Senate seat.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Republicans who think about these matters were really annoyed at Doug Collins for, you know, being willing to give up his House seat.
And his seniority on House Judiciary.
His seniority on House Judiciary, pretty important. So I think right now, Governor Kemp in no way would want to alienate the president. But at the same time, he has an argument for saying, look, I'm trying to help the party and, you know, we'll see what happens. And in the end, he may be the person who goes, you know what, I was right. You know, perhaps Doug Collins is the candidate the Democrats would want to run against and perhaps could beat because of Trump.
Mm. Dr. Audrey Haynes is an associate professor of political science at the University of Georgia and director of the Applied Politics Certificate Program. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
In recent years, the average age of onset for eating disorders has lowered to 12 years old. And now, some doctors say that children as young as 5 years old may be at risk of developing an eating disorder. From our colleagues at Georgia Public Broadcasting, Ellen Eldridge reports.
Nancy Keenan says her daughter Nori hasn't enjoyed eating since the day she was born.
She had a very negative beginning with food because she was very sick and throwing up from her breast milk. So she was just, I guess, from the beginning, wired to have a bad relationship with food.
And so Nancy thought her daughter was a picky eater, like a lot of kids. Except she never put on enough weight between doctor's visits. She'd do things like make her mom walk 2 miles for a can of chickpeas, rather than eat at a restaurant buffet on a school field trip. She cut her food into tiny pieces, so it would burn more calories to chew. Then, shortly after Nori turned 11, even she realized something was wrong.
She said, "Wow, what is it? What is anorexia?" And I said, "It's, you know, when somebody doesn't eat enough and their body weight's really low." And that was it.
And all the while, Nancy says her daughter's pediatrician never caught the severity of what was going on.
I feel like a lot of medical professionals just didn't have the training to recognize an eating disorder, and particularly in such a young child.
Nancy didn't know it at the time, but Nori had a specific type of eating disorder called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, or ARFID. Nancy now believes her daughter's been this way since birth. Dr. Anna Tanner is a pediatrician who specializes in eating disorders at Atlanta's almost 2-year-old Veritas Collaborative. She says ARFID is becoming more common, and the average age of onset has decreased from age 14 to about age 12.
We've seen patients as young as 5 and 6 here in the office. We have a lot of young ARFID patients come in between 8 and 10. And it's really, really hard for these young kids because they know they're different from their friends.
The diagnosis has only been around for 7 years. Nancy Keenan says it's often thought of as extreme picky eating.
They don't like food. They have a negative, their brains are wired so that food is not a reward. It's a punishment.
They'll do a group, and then they'll have a meal, and then they'll do a group.
What Nancy says her daughter needed was an inpatient treatment center.
There wasn't one. We didn't even have a residential treatment center here except for Ridgeview.
And the Ridgeview Institute doesn't treat people under 18. At the time, no Georgia hospital did. That left kids in Georgia and across much of the South without many options when it came to finding help. Plus, many insurance companies wouldn't cover the care that was available. Some families had to remortgage their houses to pay for treatment, says eating disorder expert Dr. Anna Tanner.
And when I had really sick patients and their families were willing to do all of this to access care, they were getting on a plane and they were flying out west.
Today, the Veritas Collaborative, where Tanner works, does see kids with eating disorders. They also treat all genders and people who may be gender transitioning. Plus, Tanner says it's now illegal for insurance carriers to deny treatment for eating disorders, but
there's still a lot of mythology around eating disorders. There's still a lot of shame and stigma around eating disorders. Eating disorders are still very under-resourced.
Tanner and Veritas are doing more than treating kids. The collaborative is also teaching healthcare providers how to recognize the signs of an eating disorder in the very young. For GPB News, I'm Ellen Eldridge in Atlanta.
After weeks of sleepless nights and countless diaper changes, new mothers often return to their desk chairs ready to continue to provide for their families. But their needs aren't being met in the professional world. In addition to the stress of motherhood, working women are struggling to find proper breastfeeding resources. Rachel McArdle is a doctoral student at the University of Georgia's College of Public Health. Her research finds that working mothers have trouble finding accessibility to breastfeed. Thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you for having me.
So, what drove you to conduct this type of research?
So when I met with my advisor and we kind of talked about this idea, we both knew that the Affordable Care Act set out these provisions back in 2010, basically allotting that there'll be a reasonable time for mothers to express breast milk as well as a private space other than a restroom. And so since it's been a decade since those came out, we wanted to see how well workplaces were doing in terms of meeting those provisions. And we found in previous literature that we're still seeing the same trend where most mothers start out breastfeeding, but once you get to 3 months and 6 months postpartum, those rates are decreasing.
Wow.
And so we wanted to see, okay, we can look at objectively and see what resources are available, but we also wanted more contextual information about the experience of going back to work, finding these resources, and kind of integrating having a new baby and trying to go back to your work life as well.
So I'm guessing that since this was kind of new research, there wasn't anything to look back to kind of shed any kind of good news. Like, how are we doing now? Were we doing worse before? Is there any shining light in that?
To what I've seen, I think there's been progress made.
Well,
we had
good.
The recent Workplace Health in America survey, where we have about 46% of work sites are offering some form of worksite wellness programs. However, only 8% actually offer lactation programs or components of that. So I believe from what I've seen, progress is being made. Certainly awareness is out there, but I think it's kind of slow to get to the rates that we want to see.
Right. Now, you found gaps in the accessibility to breastfeed. Can you talk about those gaps?
Mainly gaps. We're focusing on, again, the quality of the resource and how accessible they are. Because I think we've had a couple mothers saying, you know, yeah, I did have this designated lactation room, you could say, or like a private conference room that no one was using.
Sure.
But I felt more comfortable breastfeeding in my private office, or even there were problems with the door didn't have a lock on it, or they would walk in and it was just a room of chairs around each other, so they didn't feel as comfortable or as private as that space as it should be intended to be.
Sure. And since you were speaking to all these mothers, did you get into the impact that it might have on their efficiency and their quality of work? I mean, I can imagine if you're stressing, it might actually affect your job.
Totally. So we didn't explore that in our study, but certainly in the literature, if you have a lot of access to resources and, again, the organizational support, you do generally see increases in productivity. You see increases in employee morale in the organization. Those are the main metrics that I've seen in the research.
Well, as we close this out, what kind of thing can employers do to better ensure that women are given appropriate resources?
Yeah, so I have two parts to answer that question. The first that we talked about in our study was these occupational health nurses, which may work in some organizations. So certainly if you had any questions, you can go to them. They're there to help you either plan or even deliver a type of wellness program. And certainly lactation can fit into that.
Oh, yeah.
And even too, we talked about just start with designating somebody in the organization, whether it's an HR person, whether it's a supervisor that has the information that someone who is pregnant can go to and saying, hey, what resources do I have available if and when I do return to work and if and when I do want to continue breastfeeding my child? And then also, too, there are community resources available. The CDC has toolkits available. The one on the top of my head is from the National Business Group on Health, where they have this giant toolkit that helps you figure out how to designate a private room, how to talk to your employee about making those accommodations for breastfeeding, as well as how you go about even planning and implementing a workplace breastfeeding program.
Great. Well, that's I'm assuming those are available online?
Yes.
Well, that's great. Well, Rachel, certainly important information that you're researching, and we're just so happy that you stopped by.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Rachel McArdle is a doctoral student at the College of Public Health at the University of Georgia. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
My name is John Slights. I came into WUGA really not knowing what I wanted to do with my life. I had some ideas. I knew I loved radio, which is why I applied for the internship in the first place, but I really didn't know. And Martin Matheny, who I've been so lucky to have worked with since April of 2018, changed my complete outlook on what I wanted to do with my life. Probably the most influential person on my professional life. Learn more about WUGA internships at WUGA.org.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. With the Academy Awards coming up on February 9th, award season is officially upon us. Nominations were announced last month, and Todd Phillips' film, The Joker, racked up 11, more than any other film. Despite its critical acclaim and box office popularity, the film's depiction of mental illness has generated some backlash. Here to talk about that controversy is Dr. Gregory Strauss, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Georgia who studies clinical psychosis. Dr. Strauss, I'm sure you've seen some of the controversy surrounding the movie The Joker. The main character is portrayed as violent. He stops taking his medication, all kinds of things. Do you feel this picture of a mentally ill person could be harmful to people who suffer from psychological disorders?
Most definitely. I actually went and saw the movie after you asked me to do this interview. And I walked out of the theater with that exact thought in mind. So the idea behind this movie is one that is false, you know, that people with psychosis are to be feared, that they're violent. And the idea that when they go off of their medication, that's when the violent happens. That is also inaccurate, is what science tells us. People with psychosis, when they're unmedicated and never been medicated, are at slightly increased risk of aggression and violence. But once they've ever been medicated, even if they are go off of their medicine, the risk of violence drops. It goes right about to the level of the general population. And the after effect of portraying that notion could be to promote internalized stigma, this view that I'm someone who should be feared. I'm someone who can't live independently. And when they develop those views, people with psychosis will become depressed, and it will kind of be a self-fulfilling prophecy where they'll stop engaging in the world as much and withdraw.
Generally, people know that not all psychological disorders are on the level of psychosis. Sometimes they're just mild depression or anxiety disorders. So, how do these more extreme representations of mental illness in film affect society's perception of mental illness as a whole?
Society has always had a fascination with mental illness in a way that whatever is deviant is interesting, for lack of a better word. And I think in our society, in particular, films like The Joker confuse different forms of mental illness. You know, and they don't state which illness he's diagnosed with in that movie. But the basic idea is that that they're promoting is mental illness is dangerous, right? And we know that that's inaccurate. And also that people don't recover from mental illness. The basic idea is that there's no hope, right? That these people have something inherent in them that is dangerous to society and they should be kept out of the society. And that's just not true.
When it comes to mental illness in movies, where is the line between portraying a relatable mentally ill character and portraying them in a negative light?
There definitely are movies that portray mental illnesses more accurately, like A Beautiful Mind, for example, is a great example of that. And then there are movies like The Joker that really hit on these stereotypes of mental illness. I think that's when the line is crossed, is when the movies capitalize on the stereotypes in a way that plays off of people's preconceptions or fears that basically helps to promote that internalized stigma.
So in a movie like Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman's character has a psychological disorder, but he's not portrayed as violent. Do you think that some psychological disorders are represented more sympathetically in movies than others?
I think that there are some disorders that are more prevalent and more socially acceptable. Autism, Alzheimer's disorder are two. And I believe you're right that you do often see more positive portrayals of those disorders in the media. You also see more kind of general support in society for them in terms of people giving money to support research or treatment. Or you don't see things like that for psychosis or for bipolar disorder, for example, unfortunately, even though those are folks who really could benefit from that.
Gregory Strauss is an assistant professor at the UGA Department of Psychology and director of the Clinical Affective Neuroscience Laboratory.
Now that 2020 is in full swing and a new decade lies ahead, there's a tendency to either wax on about the future or pine for the past. For some of a certain age, yours truly included, nostalgia often seems far more inviting than the uncertainty of the future. It's comforting to recall specific moments in history by recognizing the anniversary of a particular happening that's meaningful to us. So with that in mind, I hope you'll bear with me as I remind you of a particular anniversary that not only means a lot to me personally, but one might argue should mean a lot to any fan of rock and roll. Monday, January 27th was indeed an anniversary worth noting.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lone Street, that Heartbreak Hotel.
64 years ago, a young kid from Memphis, Tennessee released a single that would go on to heights never before seen, reaching the top five in country and western, rhythm and blues, and pop charts simultaneously. The tune would go on to be Elvis Presley's first million seller and would eventually be certified double platinum, meaning that in the days before apps and streaming, more than 2 million people actually made a trip, put down their money, and came home with about 3 ounces of vinyl, their first introduction to the man who would be king. Heartbreak Hotel would go on to be recognized by just about every notable best of list, and not surprising, it's part of the Grammy Hall of Fame.
Now the bellhop's tears keep flowing, and the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on the street, they'll never look back and think
of. But the real story of the song is how it got to Elvis in the first place. Like most stories about legendary events, there are conflicting details, but basically the story goes that a woman by the name of Mayborn Axton co-wrote the song with a local performer, Jimmy Durden, after reading a suicide account that included a reference to walking a lonely street. If that last name Axton sounds familiar, she was the mother of renowned singer-songwriter Hoyt Axton. Before she married and became an Axton, Mayborn was a pioneer as a female music promoter and had become aware of Elvis after watching the crowd reactions to his performances. She made it a personal ambition to write a song for Presley, and in November of 1955, May played a demo of the song for Presley, to which he replied, according to legend, "Hot dog, May, play that again." And the rest, as they say, is history. Heartbreak Hotel, released this week, 64 years ago.
They'll be so lonely they could die.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Martin Matheny is our senior producer, and Gemma DiCarlo is our associate producer. Our segment producers are Jessica Wurst, Megan Wan, and Sophie Gratis. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget, you can hear all of the segments from this week's show and our past shows online at WUGA.org, as well as on the WUGA app, available for Apple and Android, wherever you get your apps. And of course, you can get in touch with WUGA on social media. We're at WUGA-FM on Facebook and Twitter. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News.